Before we get too far into this Fly Racing RacerX podcast, thanks to the folks at Racetech, racetech.com. Pulp24 is code to save. There's Racetech authorized service centers all across America. Get your bike dialed in. Motor work, suspension work, all of that. Tell them you listen to Pulp. They'll give you a discount. Racetech.com. All right, away we go.
A Pulp MX Network production.
Welcome to the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, and Motorsport.com on RacerXOnline.com. With your continuing gracious support of our sponsors, we're thriving at over 1,800 podcasts delivered with over 20 million downloads. Click the Amazon banner on Pulp MX to help us out. Donate via Patreon if it suits you. And as always, enrich your moto lifestyle by working with the sponsors who support us. The original Moto Podcast, featuring legends of the past, stars of today, season previews, race reviews, introspection, opinion, facts, and laughs. Here's the voice bringing it all to you, Steve Mathis.
Say that dedication, your frustration.
Welcome, everybody, to the Fly Racing RacerX podcast with Stephen Gall, Australian motocross legend. The man's done a lot. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it. Thank you to folks at Fly Racing, whether it's RJ Hampshire winning the 250 Supercross Championship, or Dean Wilson, or Max Anstey winning races, whatever it is, Fly Racing, flyracing.com. Check them out on the web or at your local dealer. The Formula helmet's amazing. Formula S helmet can save your life. I'm telling you, it's for real. Check out that app. Check out the technology involved in the Formula helmet. It's really, really cool. Thank you, folks at Fly Racing, man. They're always innovating, always elevating the game. Flyracing.com for more information on that. Thank you to the folks at Renthal as well. Bars, sprockets, they got limited edition purple bars. They are back with the folks at Renthal. Go check out your local dealer for that. And Renthal.com, Factory Honda, Kawasaki, Red Bull, KTM, you know, all using Renthal products for years and years and years. You know the quality, you know the name, and you know what they stand for. So thanks to the folks at Renthal. Also, Maxxis Tires, Stephen Gall's podcast here, brought to you by the folks at Maxxis Tires. Mountain bike tires are fantastic. They have captured the market on that. And also, you know, the light truck tires, trailer tires, they have that for you. And then, of course, dirt bike tires, the Mad Parts Kawasaki team, PRMX guys running Maxxis Tires in Supercross main events, in national motocross motos and more. Maxxis.com to learn more about that. Some guy named McGrath works with Maxxis. I think you might know a thing or two about tires. So, thank you for checking out this podcast. I had a fun few days with Steven here in Vegas while he was on a walkabout, I think is what they say, going to some races and hanging out. And we went e-biking a bunch. And then I grabbed him and put him in here in the studio to talk about all the things he's accomplished in his life, his thoughts on Australian motocross, and more. So thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Here's my Fly Racing RacerX podcast with Steven Gall. All right, everybody, here in the Pulp MX studio podcast with an Australian motocross legend, a multi-time Mr. Motocross champion, and really the guy that's kicked it all off for Australian motocross, at least to me anyways, and I'll find out more as we go along here. But I'm super excited to talk to Stephen Gall. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm great, Steve. Thank you very much for having me on today. Yeah. And look forward to it.
Yeah, we've been mountain biking the last couple of days, so that's been fun. You're up in Vegas just hanging out. You went to Salt Lake City. You're going to Hangtown and Paula and everything else, right? So it's a little vacation for you?
Yeah, it's a vacation. It's a bit of a boys' trip to do some mountain biking, which I love these days. And I really wanted to see the Lawrence boys do well, and particularly Jet at Salt Lake City. And you know, it's just great for Australia because for me, I've been all about building talent in Australia for a long time, mm-hmm. From my early career. So just to see Australia get to the top of America, to me, it's just amazing. From when I come from over here and initially to now, it just blows me out. It's great.
Yeah, you really kicked it off, late 70s, 80s. Jeff Lees carried it on, factory rider here, then went to Europe, won GPs there. Chad Reed, Michael Byrne come over, kick it off, Bette Metcalf. A little bit of a lull. Now the Lawrences are here and they're champion. I mean, I'm just jealous and bitter because Canada, my country, can never do shit, Stephen. But it's such a lineage of great Australian motocross racers. Now we're talking 40 years, 50 years. This is cool, you know?
Yeah, it certainly is cool. And we're certainly bat above our average. That's a saying that we have in Australia when it comes to overseas competition in many sports.
Yeah.
You know, we've got fantastic swimmers and cricket players and football players and things, but it's so good to see the motocross, and that's been my life.
Yeah.
You know, I've been all around motocross with various things over the years, so it's for me, it's just so special to see the Lawrence boys do so well.
Now, did you have any much interaction with Darren Lawrence, Hunter? Like, you know, obviously they're much younger, so you know, you've seen Burner, and we'll talk about your history with Burner and Chad and all that, but any involvement with the Lawrences?
No, not really. I was involved with Yamaha, or have been involved with Yamaha for 50 years now.
Yeah.
I'm a long time worker with Yamaha and ambassador now. And back in the day when Scott Bishop was running the junior team, Hunter was in the team over there.
Yep.
Jet was too young to be involved, and I really didn't even meet Jet back in those days. But I saw Hunter and how good Hunter was in those days before he went to Europe, then on to America. So good on him there. You know, Darren's done a fantastic thing for his family, and it's just a credit to them all.
Yeah, yeah, it's really cool to see, and they're great people, right? And a buckle up for people who want an American rider to win the championships in America. It might be a while. Like, this Jet kid seems pretty good.
Yeah, he certainly is. It's just amazing for me to watch him ride. And, you know, it all looks normal, central body weighting. And I've been teaching for years as well. And what he does, he just does it so well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so smooth on the bike. His throttle control's amazing. And little thing I heard about, he used to dance. And then his dad said his balance is super, super good. So obviously that's there in his body to be in the right place at the right time. And just those subtle movements that you need on a motorcycle.
Yeah, it's neat. Hey, you're a big mountain bike guy. And I got a text from a buddy of a buddy. Today, Stephen Gall is going to be in Vegas. He's got a mountain bike, and like I love it. Right, it's been something that I've been into forever. And then, I took you out on some rocky trails. You were right on me. Like, I was probably holding you up. So you're as fit as ever for your age. It's incredible. So you've really got bitten by the e-bike bug.
I certainly did, and that sort of goes back. I've been involved in mountain biking for a number of years, cycling since 78.
Yeah.
I started cycling when I tore one of my knee ligaments, the ACL. I went into cycling and because I couldn't run at that stage, so I had to keep the fitness going at my professional career. And so when mountain biking came up, I invested in one of those San Andreas alloy cruel bikes in the early 90s, which was out of America, and a cool looking bike at that stage. Probably only had 50 mil of travel both ends or something, but it's a joke when you compare it to today. But yeah, I enjoyed that. And nowadays, I just love it. And probably the little story of it, I know listeners would like to listen to, particularly the vet people out there, is why I got involved in e-biking was because I went to a funeral of a top Ironman in Australia. Okay. Now, an Ironman is a guy who swims, runs, paddles on the beach, and they're fit dudes. They're really fit dudes. And he died of a heart attack. Because he used to train too hard. I went to the funeral, listened to what everyone said. Oh, he trained hard, whether it's himself, whether it's training people. He was always redlining the heart, anaerobically working, and the heart gave up.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you're lucky when you're in the right place when your heart and you can get a defib on it to get you going and the right people around you, or you may be somewhere where you can't, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, I've trained a lot. I'm older than this guy. I'm going to go to my cardiologist and see what he says about my heart. So I went and got checked, and it came out that it was really good. I had fantastic heart volume, resting heart rates in the low 40s. Everything was really, really good. He said, but, Stephen, if you train too hard, same thing can happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, okay, I'm going to stay under 150 heart rate. Yeah. I'm going to ride an e-bike now, and I'm going to enjoy what I do, and I'm not going to compete because then the red mist comes out. You want to try too hard?
Yeah.
You know how that is.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to have fun with it, and that's what I decided to do. And so many people out there in the vet world, you know, you're plus 40 age, you've got to consider this. If you think that you only got to do anaerobic training or HIIT training all
or
the time.
E-bikes are for pussies or whatever.
People that don't get it with e-bikes because e-bikes are fit for the certain type of the community out there that's so good for them.
Yeah.
Old, overweight, hilly territory.
Yeah.
People who don't want to put in too much effort, they don't ride too often, they want to ride occasionally, want to lose some weight. It's
fantastic for them to do it. But for a motorcyclist, you go faster.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, it's too easy, but you just go faster. Just, the heart still works. Yeah, you just go quicker. Yeah. And it's more like a motorcycle, and that's why I love it.
Yeah. What did you think of the rides that I took you on? You
like
that?
Yeah, no, they've been good.
Rocky,
been good.
Not rocky for you?
Oh, it's Rock City. There's no doubt about that. But I think I told you that I grew up when I used to try ride to a park race to practice supercross. It was like a brick quarry.
Yeah.
And it was all rocky on the trails going there. So I just got used to rocks. So it doesn't really faze me. But there's certainly a few rocks here in Vegas.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Not too bad. And I should make note too, as you said, you're a Yamaha ambassador for 50 years now. You did want to ride the Yamaha e-bike, but you didn't have it with you, so we had to put you on a taser. But
Yeah.
That's got to be like so. Yeah, you never left Yamaha as a brand when you raced. You kept Yamaha the whole time.
Yep.
Which probably hurt you, by the way, racing Leask, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
But that evolved into coaching. That evolved into off-road riding and Dakar rallying, stuff like that. And obviously, like somebody told me, there's probably not a motocrosser in Australia that didn't learn from you over the years. I think, is that a proper comment from your coaching, your schooling, like something?
Well, a certain age of riders, certainly. And because I stopped it in 2003 and passed it on to my head coach, Lyndon Heffernan, at that stage.
Yeah.
And he's carried it on since then. But I had a lot of people, and I get daily and weekly people come up to me in the street or at a race meeting and say, did your school back in whatever? Had so much fun.
Yeah.
And it really puts a smile on my face. Yeah. It really does.
And then the Yamaha part of it, the ambassador now, that's pretty cool to be associated with such a great brand for that long, right?
Yeah.
They've always had your back. They supply you with things that you need to do for it to have fun. Pretty cool company.
Yeah, it is. It's built on racing, Yamaha, and they love racing, and it's just great.
Yeah.
I've really had a good rapport with the people back in Australia, and there's many areas I've been involved in, and not only just motorcycles, but I also got involved in four-wheeler training.
Mm-hmm.
For 5 years, I traveled around Australia to farm shows teaching people how to ride quads for the safety aspect.
Yeah.
I come over here to America and became a chief instructor with the SVIA to take that skill back to Australia. So I've been involved in many, many different avenues there.
They're really... over here, they got Damon Bradshaw, Villopoto, right? They've got the Blue Crew thing going on. They're giving away. I mean, they give me a bike to give away for these privateer races and fantasy. Like, they are such an aggressive, cool company. They want to be like just a supporter of cool people and cool things and cool events.
Yeah,
that's the way I look at it, right? And they're doing a good job of it. So
they certainly are.
What a life you've led. Like, when I'm thinking about talking to you, like we had lunch yesterday and today, and you told me about doing the stunt work on Mad Max movies. You've had that, the coaching aspect of it. And then, of course, you were a top racer. You raced sprint cars. You've done rallies. Like, I guess, first of all, it must seem like your motocross career, which was late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s, right? It must seem for you at your age that was almost like another guy and another life, because... like, you've done so much since the racing ended. It's got to feel like, and I was 4-time Mr. Motocross champion, right? Does that feel that way for you?
It does a bit, and it's been so long ago, but that built my name in Australia, and then I carried that name on to be able to do other things in Australia and have the pull to do other things, like the schooling around the country and AIS camps, which is the Australian Institute of Sport camps, which we started in about 93, which we took a lot of our top riders through there until the government funding fell out in Australia. We stopped it in 2016. But that's where I learned a lot about exercise physiology, psychology, recovery, nutrition, hydration, all those aspects to make you a decent trainer. I do understand a lot. It's a shame that I'm not used a bit more, actually. But anyway, that's the way it goes.
Right. What part, looking back at your life, what part was the most fun? What was... like, where you were like, because again, we'll get into it. Todd Berner, you were over here for a while working with Berner. You Motocross the Nation's Australia effort. You've been a big part of that forever. And then all the other stuff we just talked about. Like, what part where you were just like, this is so much fun?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think right now.
Really?
Yeah. I'm retired. Yeah. I'm going to races. I've got no pressure.
Okay.
I mountain bike with great people like yourself. I mean, great places to ride. But as far as a buzz is concerned, hard to beat the sprint car.
Okay.
When you're talking 800 horsepower, small clay tracks, the surface is right.
Are these mile tracks or I guess not?
No, half mile to third mile okay. we have in Australia.
Yep.
And this particular track that was our home track in Sydney in Australia called PCR, Parramatta City Raceway, mm-hmm. when the track was right, you would go wide open into the corner. The wind on the wing would wing it down.
Okay.
So pull it to left-hand yep. side. The G-forces were incredible. You know, had neck restraints yep. on. And you just go around the corner wide open, and I'm not kidding you, very close to 100 mile an hour
yeah, yeah.
around the corner.
And the car's just going.
Just going and yeah. driving. And that, to me, people ask me, what's the biggest buzz ever? Yeah. That's it.
Oh, really? Huh?
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, I've jumped 150 feet in sand dunes and all that yeah. stuff when I was younger, but yeah. to me, that sprint car aspect is the best thing.
Oh, that's cool. That's interesting. What has been, and you talk about road racing, you've done that, and the sprint cars and motocross. The rally, what has been the most challenging for you? Like, oh, you race mountain bike for a little bit, right, too?
A little bit, yeah, yeah. just for a bit of fun.
What's been the most challenging for you where you were like, I need a whole lot more time to get better at this sport or this activity?
I think it was road racing.
Road racing,
because
yeah.
back in the 80s, I got invited by the Yamaha team to ride to do some road racing in what was called the Castrol 6-hour race,
okay.
which was the premier race of the year in Australia before superbikes really got hold. It was
okay.
a production bike race.
Yep.
And I rode a number of those. I got a third and a fifth in two of those years. And I would only ride the week before the event, and I wouldn't even ride a bike on the road.
okay.
I didn't have a road license. And I'd turn up, and it just goes to show that motocross skill, and I did a lot of flat track, which the speed, the drifting yep. Yep. really helped me in that league.
Did you do flat tracking before moto when you were a kid, or no, you got into it after?
Both at the same time.
Both at the
same time. Yeah, I did moto and flat track at the same time.
Okay.
And that really helped in road racing. But I think that was the most challenging because there's a huge danger aspect in road racing.
Yeah.
And the danger in that particular era was the fences were so close. And I was very protective of myself.
Yeah.
I was a guy that didn't want to take – people might not agree with me here because they saw me do some crazy things. But skill allowed me to do those things, but I never did things outside my ability level.
Yeah.
And I've had very little injury because of that, mm-hmm. which is that's what's kept me good today. And road racing, because the fences were right there and you were scraping your shoulders on the fences sometimes coming out of corners,
yep.
where now there's big runoffs.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's much safer. If it was today, I'd love to do it. But that was the biggest challenge, not to do it, but the danger aspect
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where you were like, hey, this is – something goes wrong here. It's
– Yeah, you're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
It's a life on – I was going to say a life on two wheels for you. It's a life on wheels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're mountain biking. Now we're e-biking, right?
Yep.
And now we're just doing everything.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Let's talk CTI a little bit, because when I think of Stephen Gall, when I got that text like, hey, Stephen Gall's in Vegas, you should do a podcast with him, I immediately flash back to my early years of motocross action. I'm younger than you, but not that much. Interviews with you on motocross action. Stephen Gall's here. He's Mr. Australian motocross, blah, blah, blah. Before Jeff Leask and all that. And then at some point, I think Jody did an interview with you about being a CTI guy in Australia, and what you're doing now is sort of post-racing, right? And Jody's like, what are you doing now? And so that got me into the CTI stuff, where I was like, oh, okay. So that was a long business for you. And as you told me over lunch, it was out of necessity because you tore your knee up and you found Jim Castillo's CTI.
Yeah, that's right. That was in 86 where I tore my right ACL after
okay.
I tore my left one in 78.
Okay.
And I just put up with that.
Yeah.
I just got over it. Some people can, some people can't.
Yeah.
And that's why I took up cycling to build all the muscles in the
sure.
area really, really well. But we'll go on with more about knee rehab later on, I
yeah.
think. But I got involved. I went over to America. A guy called Brian Kendrick, who's a dear friend today, he offered me some braces for free.
Okay.
He was working with Jim.
Yeah.
So I for Brian and Jim, I said, well, look, I'll measure people in Australia for you for free for the custom knee braces
yeah.
and send you the measurements, and you can send them over. I'll do that for you because you've helped me.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I always like to do things for people to help myself. So that led into 88 when they bought out an off-the-shelf MVP
okay.
knee brace.
Yeah.
So I started to import that, and I've been doing CTI ever since.
Okay.
The CTI Classic was the initial one, the custom. Then it went to CTI 2, and now it's sort of a pre-preg CTI, which is very good. And quite honestly, I've been involved in a lot of the knee brace companies over time.
Uh-huh.
And when you get a CTI to fit you correctly, how it should, there's no better knee brace out there.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, I've been around for nearly 40 years doing this game.
Yeah.
But I will say that you still can get hurt in a brace.
Yeah.
No matter how good the fit, no matter what, yep. you still can get
yeah,
hurt
absolutely.
In there.
Absolutely. We've seen
the
it.
Right,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I've seen a lot of it. But that's the best chance. Yeah. And now in Australia, where the orthopods one day used to say, ah, no, knee bracing doesn't help. But now they go, without that knee brace, you would have had much more severe damage
yeah,
in that
yeah,
knee.
Yeah.
They're actually yeah. acknowledging that now.
So when you were doing the business, were you doing the customs or were people still getting it from California? Or were you were still measuring and then getting it sent
yeah.
to you and then giving to the customer?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah.
Fitting it up because
yeah.
we always measure, then we fit the customer. That's a
yeah.
policy.
Yeah.
Our mission statement is to make sure the customer's happy.
Yeah.
We always refit. And if we have to send it to them, we'll catch up with them somewhere.
Yeah.
As we travel through Australia, we will pull up in a McDonald's or a service station and meet them there.
Oh, I've done would it you? Yeah,
so
yeah,
many
yeah.
times.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I don't make them come to me.
Yeah,
I go
yeah.
to them sometimes.
Right. Oh, okay.
And this is what's made such a good name for
yeah.
the Gorb Brothers Medical in Australia
yeah.
because we are flexible. We try to look after the customer. Yeah. And whenever something happens, we just try to help.
I imagine for some of these motocrossers, like in 88, 89, 90s, they were like, fucking Stephen Gall measured me for my brace. Like, you know, because I mean, you're famous. You're,
yeah,
you know, you're
yeah.
well known,
that's,
right?
That's
They're probably like, holy shit. Like, so the business is still going and still...
Yeah.
Okay, and all that, yeah?
Yeah, only 2 years ago I gave it to my son,
okay.
Sean. He's doing a great job of it now.
Yeah.
He went and did a business degree at uni and was a bit lost for things to do. And unfortunately, my mum passed away and left me with a little bit of money, which helped us retire.
Yep.
And we just passed the business
yeah,
to Sean.
Here you go.
And my wife helps in the office and I
okay.
help with
yeah,
fixing
yeah.
bracing still
yeah,
and
yeah.
going to some of the events. Because what we do is we go to all the events. We set up a tent,
yep.
you know, and display the
yeah.
brace. Let people feel in touch
yeah.
because they don't realize how strong
yeah.
the CDI is. And we sell POD as well now
mm-hmm.
because one day, we used to be CTI. That was
yeah.
it. People would walk past and go, yeah, CDI. That's the Ferrari, the Porsche of braces. I can't afford
it. Can't get that. Yeah.
I can't get that. So now with POD and CTI and soon to be Alpine Star as well,
yeah.
people will go, well, they're brace specialists. That's what we have in our tent now. So we'll go and see them and see what opportunities they've got.
Yeah.
But quite seriously, when you put... The person who's got the money, when you compare and you put it on their legs, you put one on one leg and one on the other, they usually always say, oh,
the CDI,
yeah,
the custom. Yeah,
the custom, not
yeah.
no much the custom, but even off the shelf
yeah.
when it fits right.
Yep.
But the anatomy of the leg has to be right and generic to fit spot on.
Mm-hmm.
But we can adjust. We can adjust a different resin in the brace. We can actually move the ML
yep.
or the medial lateral width. We repad in different areas. We can do a lot of things to make the
yep.
brace right.
So you go to California to get a knee fixed and it ends up with a 40-year business.
Business.
right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And when Jim sold CTI, it was no problem? Like just, yeah, it was
yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah.
It went to a company called OSA, which
yep.
is an Icelandic company.
Yep.
And unfortunately, because I didn't have a lot of infrastructure set up at home, I really didn't get anything from that, which is a bit of a shame because I created the whole name of CDI in Australia
yeah,
for sure, so
right?
many years. But that was hardly... partly my fault because over those years that I did CDI, I did so many other things.
Yeah.
Work for Yamaha and the AOS camps and
yeah.
my own training camps and my poor wife is at home looking after two kids and sending braces out
yeah.
and taking phone calls and getting entries
yeah.
for schools and I'm traveling Australia. But, you know, that's a team.
Yeah.
You know, that's how teams win.
How much do you ride moto nowadays? How much do you get on a motocross track?
Yeah, quite a lot. Because
yeah.
of the Mad Max involvement, I've been back on a motocross bike
yeah.
for the last 10 or so years. I've got a brand new 24 anniversary
yeah.
450 at the moment, which I just love the
yeah.
bike. It's just,
yeah.
so, I've been told so much about how good they are. And once I got on one, I went, wow,
yeah.
this is fun. This,
yeah.
this is really nice.
So were you, when you got back into motoing, were you the type of rider that was like frustrated because your brain still knows how to ride and what you want to do and what you should do and what you used to do, but maybe your body can't, or maybe you're not as sharp, you're not as good a shape, even though you're in good a shape, there's still that moto shape, right? That's different.
Mm.
Were you okay with just being like, I'm just an older vet guy now? Or do you get frustrated?
No, I get frustrated.
Okay. Where you're like, God damn it.
I do things that I go, I
yeah.
know how to do that.
Right.
And I just didn't do it right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I finish the session and think about different things. And because my knees are so bad, even wearing the CTIs, I avoid ruts as much
yeah.
as I can. I run berms. I do outside
right,
lines.
Right, right.
You know, I do all these things, which isn't me
yeah.
what, back in the day.
Yeah.
But quite seriously, I still can go reasonably quick. But Yeah, I just try to keep it to a level. I don't try to race anymore. Yeah, I just go ride with friends. Jeff Leask and I ride a lot together. Okay. I've got other friends, Mel Dalton, different people in Australia that I ride with. Yep. We just have fun.
Yeah, okay. So you're okay with that a little bit?
Totally. You know, we sit down, have a coffee afterwards, or chew the fat at the racing, it's fun.
The stunt work. You did the Fury Road years ago. Now then there's a new one coming out, Furiosa. How'd you get involved in that? What's that all about?
It's a bit of a story, that one. Well, the main stunt man back in the 78 and the 81, 83 versions, Guy Norris.
Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson era, yep. Well, Guy Norris, the stunt coordinator, he rang me up in 98 or 99, right near the end of my 5-day schooling period.
Okay.
And he said, "Oh, Gawley, would you teach me anything on a motorcycle?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know."
20 years later, he was still doing stunts, this guy. From the early
80s. Being involved, more a coordinator stage. I said, "Yeah, you come along, Guy." And I said, if I can't teach you anything, don't pay me.
Yeah.
Simple as that. Yeah. But if I teach you, maybe, give me some money.
Did you know him before or no?
No.
Oh, so cold called you, yeah.
I knew who he was.
Okay, you did, yeah.
So he came to the school. We had a great time together. He did a demo on how to fall, which if you ask me later about what was my ingredients to produce the best motocross rider, I'll tell you about that, and that'll come later on. But he came along and showed us all this. And then 8 years later, he rings me up. "Steven," he said, "I've got a bit of a project going on." He said...
8 years later.
Seven or eight. Yeah. And he said, "I've got these bikes. I want to extend the swing arm. We're doing a movie." He didn't say what it was.
Okay.
"Doing a movie. Would you help me? Both live on the Gold Coast in Australia, and I'll help you. Yeah. No problem." I had a bit of time at that stage, and I didn't ask for any money. I just went out and helped him. I had a ride of this R1 with a 22-inch extension in the swing arm, which was so much fun to ride. Like, being a flat tracker and all that stuff, drifting the thing around without too much steering lock. The thing's got unlimited power. It's just unbelievable. But we had a lot of fun, and that finished up doing a pre-production period of 6 weeks out at Broken Hill for Mad Max Fury Road. Then there was a year where Broken Hill got too wet and too green.
Okay.
And the era of that stage, they couldn't cut out the background with the post-production.
Yeah. So we look apocalyptic. Yeah.
So we moved to Namibia, which is on the west coast of Africa, above South Africa. And it's a beautiful area for it. And it was so desolate and desert-like. And so I was there for 8 months doing that movie. Lived there for 8 months.
Your poor wife.
Well, every night I'd sort of talk to her on the computer and see the kids. And it was a tough time, but
good money though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Stunt stuff pays.
Stunt stuff does pay if you can stay healthy.
A lot
of people get hurt.
Right.
But again, it's smart coordinators, smart ideas of what you do.
Yeah.
Got to be careful, because in that particular movie, probably one of those dangerous stunts, which I helped coordinate, but I wasn't riding the bike, was when four of my guys, Michael Addison, Robbie Marshall, who's still does freestyle and motocross.
Robbie Madison?
Not Madison, Robbie Marshall.
Okay.
He's still a friend of Robbie Madison, but does some crazy stuff as well. Michael Addison from West Australia and Cody Mackey.
Okay.
And Cody Mackey's over here now doing stunt work.
He's an old racer. He raced.
He raced. He was factory Cowie for a while. He's a great rider and a good jumper.
Okay.
So I chose them for different reasons, and two of them were sand specialists. I knew we had to ride in sand a lot. But they had to jump over the war rig, which is that truck with the war boys on top. Had to jump over the cab and look as though they were throwing incendiaries onto the window to sort of blow it up. And they had to just clear the front of the cab. The truck's going down the road at about 40 mile an hour, 70 kilometers an hour, and they're jumping across. And we had to design the ramps to build so they just missed the truck and land in dirt hollows. So they had to land specifically. So three come from the right-hand side and one come from the left, which was Sean Ford, a South African motocross rider.
Okay.
And it was touch and go, I tell you.
Yeah, was it?
And we had to do it. There's never one take.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, there's always several. And the poor boys, it was heart in the mouth stuff. They had to time it themselves. When I say that, they had to look at where the war rig came down the road. It's doing 40 mile an hour or 50. And then they had to go, okay, now's the go. Then one would go. The second one would go. And the incendiaries would be triggered by a guy up on the hill watching. So when the bike got just across the cab, across the blower, boom, it would go off. But that was smoke and stuff. And the driver, Lee Adamson, he had to stay in the middle of the road, because if he drifted to the right, that then compensated the distance where the bikes would just miss the wall rig on one side.
Yeah, yeah.
If you went to the left, that's where they landed.
Yeah.
So he had to stay straight down the middle, Paul Lee, he's a bloody good truck driver, and he's still doing stunts today for in truck work, but it was a tricky one.
Yeah.
But when the boys finished that, my heart was in my mouth. I'm going, oh, I'm glad that's over. But that was the most dangerous for sure.
Oh, that's cool. And then you worked on the new one. The new one,
Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Yeah. We did that 2 years ago. I was one of many stunt guys there. And that was actually easier riding. There wasn't too much difficulty with riding.
Yeah.
Fury Road was a lot tougher.
Yeah.
That's why they had a specialist group. But this time it was fairly easy. It was just timing, gapping, different things. You know, some people think it's hard, but if you can ride all right, you know, timing and gaps and controls all right, it's not too tough.
It's not too bad. But so is that something you want to do more of? Obviously, these are just two George Miller Road Warrior movies, and you know the coordinator guy, but do you want to do more? Or?
Not really.
No, okay.
No, I don't care. Yeah. If something came up, it was within my realm of difficulty that I could handle, and it wasn't super dangerous, I'd do it, no problem. But I probably won't get a call up because I'm not an official stunt guy.
Yep.
I've never been graded as a stunt guy in Australia, although I'm a member of the stunt association there.
Yep.
But it's something that's sort of fun. I did get offer after that Fury Road, but it was dangerous what it did. And I said, no, thanks.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I've always been a bit careful with what I do.
Right. Coming to America, obviously, you know, you were a multi-time Mr. Motocross champion and one of Australia's best. I'm interested, did you come here, and I mean, I know you did, I know the answer is yes, but would you come and race Golden States? Did you do any nationals or supercrosses? Did you, you know, you would come here and preseason stuff and all that? Like, how many years did you do that for?
I did it for 5 years, from 80 through to 85, and I spent my own money in doing it. It was like my apprenticeship to motocross.
Yeah.
Bringing that skill and techniques and different aspects of motocross back to Australia, which I would
buy a bike here and then just
Yamaha would give me one in the later years, or I'd hire one for the time.
Okay.
Initially we bought them, then we sort of got it from Yamaha back in the after that. Yamaha's always been so good to me, but it was really good because I did some Golden States, but not a lot because it meant a lot of travel within California.
Yeah.
But mainly rode Saddleback Park, Corona, night racing, Carlsbad.
Yeah.
Different races like that in the area, which was really good. And what was good about coming over, you could ride three times a weekend.
Yeah. You could make some money too, right?
Yeah. And there was some prize money to make and sort of just offset the cost of being here.
When you did the Golden States, how'd you fare against, you know, Glover or Johnson or any of these other, were you in the mix with those guys or how did you feel?
Initially, I was back there.
Okay.
Towards the end of it, I was up there a little bit
more.
Yeah,
yeah.
And for instance, at Saddleback Park, I used to tell my kids at my schools this so much, to be humble about who you are or what you do, because I was the best in Australia.
Yep.
I came to Saddleback Park, and then I was racing for just inside the top 10.
What happened?
And this is the locals.
Right.
This is the locals in California. I'm going, where am I here? This is unreal. The competition's so good.
Yeah. So and it's California hard pack too, which is a different animal.
But you know what, Saddleback, they used to chew it up and become one line, then developed into lines as the day went on. Never got that rough.
Yeah.
But it taught me a lot. It really taught me a lot to be humble and understand that there's a lot better people out there than what you think you are.
Yeah.
And it was just good for me though, because at the start I was racing like I just said. Then at the end I was near the front of the pro race.
Yeah.
And racing with guys like Ron Turner and Goat Brecker and those guys are up there because I'd improved myself so much over the years.
Right. And like a guy like Goat, like you're still friends with him to this day. You met him in early 80s, and you're still friends with Goat Brecker.
Yeah, I met Goat through his father, Dick Brecker, and they're a lovely family. And Goat's, I've had more fun with Goat over the years than anyone in my life.
Really?
Seriously. he has provided so much fun. And those people who know Goat will just have a smile on their face right now and go, that's Goat.
Yeah. I tried to do a podcast with him. He told me no one cares and I'm not interested. Yeah. He hung up the phone.
He's that sort of guy.
He was not in doing a podcast.
Unfortunately, because he has got some great stories.
Yeah, Mitch Payton loves the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and absolutely has great stories.
Well, speaking of Mitch, the first time I came to America, I went to see Mitch.
Okay.
In his little shop, and he came around the corner in his wheelchair.
Was he Husqvarna then, or was he
Husky? And he had swarf all over him from porting a cylinder. And now I see him now from then, and it's so good.
Yeah.
You're like, I just want to pat the guy on the back and go, Mitch, you've just done so much for the sport and your life. And good on you, mate.
And you know what? I go in there in the off season, and he's grinding away.
Yeah,
on a cylinder.
Still.
Like, especially he loves KX80s and like he just loves KX80s. He's got a great, you know, porting program for him and he'll be in there with an 80 cylinder grinding away still. And I used to laugh. I laugh and I'm like telling him, I'm like, do you think that cylinder if it's going to Nebraska, that guy knows that Mitch Payton did the cylinder. Yeah, yeah. He goes, he would never believe you. And Mitch goes, huh?
Yeah, I don't care. I just enjoy doing it.
Right.
But that's what he's a great guy.
So you'd come here, and in preparation for the Australian series, of course, do some Saddleback, do some Golden States or whatever. Did you have, Leask went from Australia to GPs. Dak tried it, right? These are guys a little after you. Did you ever want to do that? Did you want to come here full time? Did you want to go to Europe? Did you have any chances to do that?
No, not really, because I never thought that I was good enough in the early days. Although Kenny Clark used to be the manager of Yamaha Racing, he offered me a bike for a Coliseum race, but that turned out to be everyone had to have an FIM license, which meant I had to buy everyone that raced against me an FIM license, which I couldn't afford, $600-something each. So that went down the chute.
Okay.
But it's something that I never really considered because I was making reasonable money in Australia, and I thought, well, as a saying we have in Australia, little fish is a sweet.
Yeah.
We'll just stick with what I've got and not try to renew everything and possibly go backwards.
Yeah.
I've tried to have a bit of a commercial mind on what I've done over the years and not try to think too big.
Yeah. What's the state of Australian motocross now? Like, I feel like I did Josh Coppins podcast not that long ago, and I talked to him a little bit about that. Obviously, he's in New Zealand, but he's still, he's got his finger on it. I feel like Canadian moto, we were kind of doing well. Lots of semis, lots of racers. Purse money was up. We had a title sponsor, and then COVID hit, and we haven't recovered up in Canada, Canadian Pro Series. It's getting there, but still not. And I feel like Australia, maybe not as hard as the Canadian series, has been hit the same. I mean, obviously, you guys have a very successful Supercross series, which is a good thing. But what's the state of Aussie motocross?
It's actually really good.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely improved now. Motocross itself took over Kevin Williams, and Williams Event Management did a great job for a number of years, and he handed it back. And then MA, or the AMA of Australia, took over. And Peter Doyle, who used to be the race manager for Matt Mladen, 7 times American Superbike champion, well, Peter's now the CEO of MA in Australia. He's doing a great job.
So he's very proactive.
He's steering it really, really well. In comparison to all of the guys before that were trying to rip the sport off rather than help the sport, where Peter's totally different.
Yep.
So it's going well, and they're running a great series. It's on TV now.
Okay.
Superbikes and motocross are on TV, and it's really good for the sport, good for the sponsors.
Yeah.
Plenty of semis there, plenty of private teams.
Yeah.
And let's face it, the Lawrence brothers are helping the sport in Australia.
For sure, right?
Those kids that see Jet and Hunter do so well, they look up to those kids, and that's the first thing I said to Jet and Hunter when I met them in France last year for the Motocross of Nations. I said, thank you guys for doing so much for Australia.
Yeah.
I said, you may not know it.
Yeah.
I said,
at this point, they don't even probably think about it, right?
But for me, seeing the kids out there trying to ride, mum and dad putting all that money, because it's damn expensive to travel Australia. Australia's nearly as big as America.
Yeah.
And to travel around and do all the rounds, it's expensive. So I just take my hat off to those people that follow the racing and help their kids and try to give them something. But let's face it, in today of drugs and bad things that are out there in life, to spend the money on your kid to give them direction is a really good thing.
Even if they don't succeed and become Jet Lawrence, they've got the discipline, the guidance, the toughness, all the things that motocross gives you, right?
Exactly.
You've been really an advocate for Team Australia for the Motocross of Nations. I wish we had someone like you up in Canada. You got involved with them straight after your racing career. You got to go to Finland in 84, right?
Yeah.
Sweden or Finland?
No, 84. It was in Sweden.
Sweden, Finland.
To Finland and watched the Motocross of Nations.
Yeah.
Then we competed in the Trophy of Nations.
In the Trophy, right. And you really pretty much seems like after your career was over, you straightly started managing, helping Motocross Australia, getting a team every year. You've been involved with it forever. So that's like a passion for you to help this team get on America's motocross stage?
Yeah, without a doubt, because the very first year I rode in 84 in Varberg in Sweden, I was one of a 4-member team of Trevor Williams and Vaughan Style and David Armstrong and myself when it was Trophy to Nations. And next year went to Motocross of Nations, which was a 3-man team. So it changed after that. But for 10 years, I was very, very involved as team manager and to help out.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy called Len Williamson, who started the very first motocross school in Australia with another guy, and it was called Soft Earth Motocross School. And that's where they asked me to do demonstrations.
Okay.
And that's how I got the love of teaching people.
Yeah. So this is just after your racing career?
No, this is during the early days.
Okay.
Early days, because I started teaching
virtually when I turned pro. I started teaching at the same time because I just love the sport and I love to help people and I love to see people. And even today, it nearly brings a tear to my eye when I see a guy finish. It doesn't have to be motocross. It's someone who's tried all their life and maybe gets a gold medal at the Olympics or something.
And it
brings me a bit undone because I can see their effort.
Right.
And I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. So, yeah, it's been something for me all my life to be involved.
Third 2 years ago, second last year for Australia.
Yep.
Only one more step to go.
Only one more step.
But they could do it.
They certainly can do it. We've put a lot of effort in this year to raise money for the team.
Yeah.
Different things we're doing to improve our third rider, our Aussie third rider.
Who's your third rider right now if you had to pick? I mean, look, it's May. So if you a lot of things can change.
There's two guys after four rounds of the series that have stepped out from everyone else, and that's Jed Beaton, who spent many years in Europe, and there's Kyle Webster. And they're both within a point of each other. Kyle's leading at the moment. And Kyle's a young guy that I taught as a young kid when I was doing Yamaha support way back, and I've had a lot to do with Kyle. He's a lovely guy. I tell you, he's just such a nice guy. And people don't realize he's broken his back. He's got prosthesis up and down his
spine. Oh,
really?
Oh, I didn't know that. And he's still out there doing it.
Yeah. He's so determined to do well. So I'd love to see him make it, but he isn't as good in the hard as he is in the sand or the softer, muddy condition.
Mm-hmm. Which could be Matterley in September, October.
Could be. Yeah. That's right. It could be. Could be wet. So and Dean Ferris is third at the moment.
Yep.
And Dean's an experienced punter. He's won the Australian Championship four times. You know, Dean's a really good guy. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
One of those three, if everything goes right.
I reckon he'd be one of those
three. Would you put Hunter back on a 250 or would you put this dude on the 250?
That's up in the air at the moment.
Okay.
I know a bit. I can't say it about what possibly could happen.
Yep.
But we've got a few aces to possibly throw in there.
Okay.
And so we'll wait and see what happens with who develops out of Australia. And just hopefully the two Lawrence boys don't get hurt.
Yeah.
Like last year. Look, 2 weeks out, Hunter got hurt.
Yeah.
And that sent a shiver down my spine.
Yeah, no. So how many years involved in Aussie MXDN?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I had a bit of an era where I wasn't involved.
Okay.
I didn't go too much around the 90s, 2000s and that. I was busy with my own business.
Yeah, yep.
But right up until mid-90s and then the last number of years I've been involved. Now the Lawrence, we're in an era where we possibly could win. And I've got time. Yeah. I'm doing everything I can to raise money, to do whatever I can to help the team because it's been a goal of mine to see us on the top step.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it'll bring a tear to my eye when it happens.
Yeah. Well, listen, they can do it. It's not a dream. They're that good, right, everybody?
No,
so,
it's not a dream. It's a reality.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, look, so my country didn't even make the A final last year, Stephen. So, Stephen Gall here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast presented by the folks at Renthal Maxxis Motorsport.com. Please check those guys out. Lots more to talk to you about. So you do the coaching from 88, you know, after your riding career, 88 or so,
yep.
Get into coaching.
Full time
till 2003, basically. Coaching all across the country of Australia. At some point, you get a little more coaching, a little more teaching with the Australian Institute, right, where that kind of taught you more about physiology and training and all of that. And you can see that in talking to you the last couple of days that you're very knowledgeable about this. It's more of a passion of that. When you combine the knowledge of how the human body works and the physiology of stuff combined with how to ride a dirt bike fast, it really teaches you a lot, doesn't it?
It does.
It really makes you a sort of a well-rounded coach, right?
Exactly.
I feel like you're pretty passionate about that.
I am passionate, and for years since 84 I've been writing columns in our biggest motorcycle magazine, the Australian Dirt Bike Magazine, about technique, about nutrition, hydration, physiology, all the different things. And so I only stopped that 2 years ago. I did that for 39 years, once a month for 39 years. So it was quite a long tenure to do that, but I had to step away. I just wanted an easy life, you know, not have to do things.
Hey, listen, I'm a writer, so I understand. Sometimes you got nothing. You're staring at a blank page and you're like, I got no ideas. But we were talking about this a little bit, and again, like, your credentials are pretty impressive. I have to laugh at these coaches on the internet, like these either ex-pros or current pros, and they show you a photo of, like, well, now it's Jet Lawrence, a couple years ago it was Chase Sexton, and they post a photo or a video and they're like, that's exactly what I teach. That's how I teach the Jet Lawrence or Chase Sexton way. And it always strikes me as so ironic that it just happens to be the fastest rider in the country at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's how they teach. I feel pretty strongly, and I don't even have a quarter of your knowledge, that with your Ricky Carmichael, your 5'7", and maybe a little chunky, or your Mike Bell, 6'3", skinny, Travis Preston, you can ride and win and race a dirt bike, and that's a great thing about our sport, in any type of body.
Yep.
Do you agree?
I totally agree.
And you can ride how you want to ride.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because these days, you know, I say to a lot of people that it depends on the rider too, because every rider is different.
Yep.
Some rider wants to be critiqued on their technique all the time and yep. just to fine tune that. And they think that that's important. But the most important thing at an upper level isn't your mind, how
yeah.
much you want to win, the team around you to create that want in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's where you've got to fine-tune the program to suit the individual. And it is very, very hard to do that exactly right.
Yeah.
But it's so important. Like you say, there's so many riders that have got weird techniques, but
yeah.
they still go fast because
yeah.
they want to go
right.
fast. They hold the thing on. They might flap around a little more,
yeah,
but they
yeah.
hold the thing on.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jet's got an unbelievable technique.
Right. Okay, if you could teach anybody, I agree. Teaching to ride like Jet, guess what? That ain't easy. That's
yeah.
something you're born with,
yeah,
right?
That's right. And
yeah.
Like if I go right back into the 80s when I started teaching,
yeah.
I used to teach the American way
yeah.
because I learned it over here that they stay very central.
Elbows up.
Yeah. Gripping the bike with your legs.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, I broke the sport down and I did off-track exercises. A lot of the exercises with front brake stoppies and skids and things mm-hmm. to build technique,
yeah.
and I can come back to talking about that later, but all of those aspects are so important. And I used to teach the American's central position on the bike, which mm-hmm. evolved from America more, and just Jet's got it to a finer level
yeah.
now.
Yeah,
you know, but you still see over the yeah. years, Ricky used to hang off the back of the bike a lot.
Yeah,
and but
Villopoto did too.
Yeah, because they were smaller guys,
yeah.
But they still went really
yeah.
fast.
No, I just have to laugh at the coaches out there. It's like, really? Yeah, that's the way you teach? Okay, imagine that, right?
Yeah.
It's just, I just find it hilarious at times. And it strikes me that you're pretty smart about this stuff as well. So that leads me into training with Berner. Now, at some point in the late 90s, you took Berner and some kids and some Australian motocross people to California for a little while.
Yeah, we did it for
two years.
We had 10 or 12 guys at a time. We
yeah.
went over there for a month to California. They paid their own way.
Yeah.
I didn't get a lot of money from them. They covered my airfare or something, accommodation.
Yeah.
But I did it because I love to help people,
yeah.
as I always do. And
you knew the tracks and you knew what to do and, you know, that
yeah,
kind of stuff.
Took
yeah.
them around. I right. drove the van, loaded yeah. the bikes up. We all went out. We had a good time together. And Goat was really funny during that time.
We had some
enormous times with Goat and these young Australians. But
I'll ask Berner next time I see him.
Yeah. You might get some funny replies there. But anyway, Goat was involved a lot. He helped a lot through those times. But Michael Byrne did it. Rod Fagater, who finished up riding Dakar for Factory Yamaha, he was involved in it. Many top Australians were involved in that. And it was all just to give them experience in California, where they could ride three times a weekend, you know, over four weekends to get a massive riding.
Yeah.
We went to the gym. We ate well and we trained every day. And it was fun.
It's kind of neat.
Yeah, it was.
So you teach Berner, you've been to California, you've known him since he was little, and then he gets you as a trainer.
Yeah, he rings me up one day, and he went, I've got faith in you, Steve. And he said, would you come across and help me? I'm struggling a little bit with Team Kawasaki. And so I spent the first year with him just for 3 months at a time with my visa.
What year was this? 03?
It was 04 because I just got out of the Academy of Off-Road Riding School to Lyndon Heffernan in Australia.
Yep.
It was 04.
Yep.
And then I spent 3 months stints over here, which was really cool.
Was that on the bike or off the bike or both?
Both.
Yeah, both.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, both. Just like technique and then cycling and things like that.
And a story about that too, to go back to basic technique, is when I first got involved with Michael, we were at the Kawasaki factory practice track on the edge of the 15 there.
Yeah.
And I spotted him going around and not really using his front brake that good. So I said, oh, Michael, let's just do some skill work on the flat start straight area.
Yeah.
And really found out that his front brake work wasn't that good. He'd morphed into being flowing into corners and not really using the brake that much. And admittedly, you do carry flow. You don't need to use the brake sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it all depends on the situation. But we worked on front brake skills just on flat ground.
Yeah.
And that improved him. And we did a lot of things like sector times on the track, which really another great example of what we turned up one day. James is out there riding. James and Michael Byrne of the factory of Kawasaki. Bubba's out there riding and doing this rhythm section, just unbelievable.
Right.
We pull up and Michael looks at him and go, "Oh, I can't do that," he says to me. And I said, "Oh, it's all right, Michael. Let's just do this today." I said, "Go and have a ride, get warmed up. We're going to break the track down into four sectors."
Yeah.
I said, "I'm going to have a lap board." Then we didn't have electronics. "I'm going to have a lap board. And every time you do the sector, I'll show you the lap board and see what time you do. So you can reflect what you just did to that time." And so we did that 20 times in each sector, went around the track, put together the best time of each of those sector. Yeah. And now he's only 0.3 of a second off Bubba.
Bubba, yeah.
And he went, "Oh, yeah, I can do that."
Right, yeah. Yeah.
That's not impossible.
Yeah, I can break it down and I can stay lower in that turn and lower in that turn. Yeah, and whatever.
Flow this turn more, carry more momentum on the starters, whatever, blitz them, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So little things like that made a big difference. And that's when, unfortunately, Michael was just starting to go really, really well and he hurt his thumb at the Vegas Supercross.
Mm-hmm.
Tore his thumb back, which put him out for 2 months. 2 or 3 months with the factory Kawasaki off-road, like a motocross situation.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had to move him on, and he lost his ride, which was such a shame.
Well, Tim Ferry got it, though, so I was happy about that.
Yeah, you were his mechanic, Well, good for you, but bad for me.
Yeah.
I really wanted to see Michael do well.
You like that sort of, like, full-time, three months at a time? Like, did you enjoy that?
I really thought that I'd gone to the upper echelon of training from what I'd done in Australia.
Yeah.
Because then when Michael went out, I got a phone call, or Bubba saw me at the track. He went, "Stephen," he said, "I like what I see with what you do." He said, "Would you train me?"
Yeah.
And I went, I'm thinking, wow, one of the best guys in America just asked me to train him. I couldn't believe it.
Right.
I really couldn't.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, Matt Mladen, who's won now six American flat superbike, he rings me and says, "Would you train me?" So now I've got this decision of what to do. And quite honestly, looking back, I made the wrong decision to try to do both at the same time.
Okay.
I stayed with Michael in California, with Matt in California, and I had someone, Shane Booth and Cody Mackey, went over to Florida to work with James. So unfortunately, I had problems with both situations. I won't go into the situation, but I had problems with both, and I finished up going home after 6 months with a tail between my legs, which is another example of Australian colloquialism, to say I was so disappointed and nearly a tear in my eye that I thought I could go on to something. Because I remember Jeff Emig saying to me, "I got this young guy that needs a trainer." You know who that young guy was? Ryan Dungey.
No, really?
And he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
I probably could have really done something with Ryan. You know,
I don't know Mladen, but I've heard a lot of Mladen stories. He's an aggressive individual, let's say. And then James and the dad and the mom, and that's a lot to balance between those two personalities.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
I don't want to go into it. So I don't want to create any bad stories out there, but I had problems.
Maybe I'll hit pause and you can tell me.
Yeah, I certainly had problems, but unfortunately it fell out and I got the shits with it and I went, stuff this, I'm going home.
That's it, yeah.
I'm going home.
What's the number one sort of mistake that you see training wise for motocross racers, off the bike? Like, what do they cycle too much? Do they not cycle enough? Do they not vary their stuff up? Like, certainly Alden Baker's got all the credentials here and he does a great job. He's a good friend of mine. But you know, the critics of his program are like, "Hey, we're not doing the Tour de France. We're racing motocross." But I look at all those number one plates on Alden's wall and I'm like, well, that looks like it works pretty well. So anyways, there's lots of ways to skin a cat. That might be a Canadian thing. I don't know.
Nah, good in Australia too.
Oh, it is? Okay. Yeah. Skin a croc. Skin a roo. But what do you think? If someone said to you right now, "Hey, Stephen, Jet Lawrence wants you to train him." What do you put him on? What kind of program do you do?
Well, let me digress for a second.
Sure.
And let me go back to talking about the fact that you designed the program to suit the individual. So if they're a young guy, then the program is very different to a pro.
Yeah.
A pro knows how to ride. You've got to get his program together to what he likes. He's got to enjoy what he does because he's been doing it for a long time.
Yep.
And you've got to put a smile on their face. And I tried to do that with James when I was training him. I tried to make things fun. I didn't do an Alden, and I didn't make him do this and make him do that. I tried to work with him, which did work, but then for other reasons it backfired.
Okay. How long was that for with James? How long did you
have? 6 months.
6 months, okay.
Pre-season and end of the season a little bit. And I got blamed for some problems that he had on track, which entirely wasn't my fault,
right.
But I got blamed for it, and that's what took me out of the situation.
So you tailor the program.
I've learned over the years that tailoring the program is so critical. And one of the, you asked me what the biggest mistake is.
Yeah.
I think the biggest mistake is a lot of riders and pros these days is they ride on tracks that are too easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is what was happening with Michael when I was working with him. And we were riding in Californian tracks like Elsinore and different tracks around here, around there, because we're in
Vegas
at the moment. Yep. And it was too easy.
Yep.
Sure, you could go fast on those tracks. When you go to a national track, things churned up. It's rutted. Yeah, yeah. It's rough. It's difficult.
Right.
And they're out of their league because they're on a different track. So, you know, over the years, I've developed a principle too that good talent comes from difficult conditions.
Okay.
So an example of that would be Bubba and RC coming from sand, Jeff Leese coming from a sand background in WA in Australia, Kyle Webster's winning the 450 championship. He comes from a sand background too. When conditions are tough, those guys shine because they're used to the bike jumping around, moving underneath them to control a bike in difficult conditions. Jean-Michel Bale had a really difficult kid where he lived, where he was brought up.
Oh, okay.
And he developed his skill by a very difficult area. And if you put anyone, for instance, we've got our national superbike champion at the moment, Troy Herfoss.
Okay.
He came from a farm and he did super motard, he did motocross. Now he's one of the better road racer guys. He's winning the Baggers Championship on Indian over here in America now.
Yeah.
If you have a difficult background with difficult terrain and not just a motocross track, it could be making a track out in the bush.
Yeah.
An example of this is one of the second times or third time I came to America, I went out training or riding with Goat and Jeff Ward.
Okay.
Factory Kawasaki guys went out into the riverside hillside.
Yeah.
And they were geared up. They got on their bikes pretty quick. I'm getting my gear on. I'm looking at them ride around this track. Oh, yeah, it looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I went out to do it. I couldn't ride around the first lap. I couldn't get up some of the hills.
Okay.
And what did that tell me?
Yeah.
That tells me that here I am, the best guy in Australia, and I can't even ride around this frigging track. And that's why these guys are good, because they ride in difficult conditions. And those people that go out and ride in simple tracks, they just don't get it.
Right.
I see that in our young pros at home. They go ride where I ride.
Yeah.
Sure, I ride that because I'm a vet. I'm 67
years
of age.
Right.
I want to cruise around a smooth track and have fun these days. I don't ride on crappy tracks.
Well, it's like Ricky's mom said, the easiest day should be Saturday, right?
Yeah.
So whatever you're putting yourself through during the week.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
And then back to Alden. Yeah. Alden's theory of develop, that's great if you can handle it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that just can't handle that intensity of training.
Well, the critical part of Alden, and he knows this, is he's stacking the same workload for 29-year-old Alex Martin as he did for 17-year-old Adam Cianciarulo, and you can't do that, right? Alex Martin, when he did the program, needed rest, and AC got, you know, not Epstein's, but something like that, you know, and it just was too much for a younger person. So Alden doesn't do a lot of flexibility. It's we're doing, this is the work, you know?
And,
so there is a little bit of that, yeah.
Well, mate, I don't know what the program is these days, but I did hear back in the day when I was working with Berner, that my program of how I designed the week was very similar to Alden's.
Okay.
Really, really similar. Yeah. Maybe the level of intensity was different.
Yeah.
But even Michael said to me a few years ago, reflecting on my time with Michael, and he said, maybe we did it a little bit hard. But in reflection, Michael wasn't to the level we needed to be when I got to him.
Yeah.
And I was trying to bring him up.
Yeah.
And he was getting right up there towards the end until that thumb took him out of the situation. So unfortunately, Michael just was a little bit fragile and he got hurt a little bit.
Yep.
And I'm so sorry for him because he had the skill.
Yeah, he did. No, he did.
Yeah.
He got a few podiums. You know, he definitely had some great rides. But you watch him technically on a bike and he was really good.
So
you know,
good.
I'm so happy for Berner. He's working with the Lawrences, obviously. He's got the whole crew at the compound there, and he's got a bunch of guys he trains, and he's been a manager of the MXDN team now.
Yep.
At this point, I think the world of Michael Byrne. When he was top factory rider, there was no ego, nicest guy, treated everybody the same. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And he's the same way now. And I love, he's been through some ups and downs and injuries, and you know, he had to hang it up early. And I think the world of Michael Byrne.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
I'm a Michael Byrne fan, so I'm glad everything's going well for him, you know, at this point. So
great guy.
All right, let's get in the time machine a little bit and go way back. 1978, you turned pro?
Yep.
So as a kid in Australia before that, you're getting on a bike. You got a 74, right? You told me 74.
Yeah, YZ.
Yep.
First ever YZ.
Are you like realizing like, hey, I'm an amateur motocross racer and I'm winning or I'm really good and like naturally gifted, naturally like from the start you seemed like you always been in shape and fitness and you worry about, you know, being in shape. That seems like a lifelong thing for you. Were you like, I think I can be pretty good at this?
Yeah, luckily I came off a farm as well, and
okay.
My dad had an oiled go-kart dirt track in the backyard. I started mm-hmm. go-karting when I was 5, and then motorbikes came in when I was 11, but I had grass to ride on, flat track grass.
Okay.
I built jumps to do motocrossish style thing. I had flat track up there. So I really, and then I had terrain that was rocky, a bit like the Jean-Michel Bale backyard right down the back. We used to ride rocks and different things. And I got all round ability through that. And when I started riding, I just seemed to do well straight away.
Yeah.
So I went, oh, I'll have a go at this.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not too bad.
Yeah.
And then my dad wouldn't even let me race initially.
Oh, okay.
So a boss of Motorcycling Australia, who was the controlling body at the time, he came and talked to my parents, said, just let him ride in some club races with the St. George Motorcycle Club, and it'd be all right. So that developed, didn't it? That developed from club racing. And I did well straight away, which was great, and just went on to bigger
things. Is
there
like a Loretta Lynn's of Australia, like an amateur national championships or anything, or no? Not really?
Not really.
No, okay. No. So you were just basically like progressing in 80s, schoolboy.
Yeah,
you know, like
it wasn't
that.
Even 80s. I was straight onto big bikes.
Oh, straight onto big bikes?
Yeah, I went from a 60 to a 250 YZ.
Jeez.
And I just adapted pretty quickly, and I must have had some skill with it. And my riding every afternoon when I come home from school and riding to those brick pits I talked about through the rocks.
Yeah.
And I just got good all-round ability back in the day. And fitness wasn't a big thing back then, but I rode a lot.
Yeah. So in Canada, like the National Series, when I was a kid in the 80s, it was 125 to 5500s, you know, for a long time. You rode 3 pro classes, 6 minutes, or 6 motos, 30, 40 minutes a moto. Ross Patterson, right? It was my hero growing up. I'm sure you're familiar with him. Is it like that for Australia? Like, was that what you were doing? You were racing all 3 pro classes and winning?
Yeah, no, we'd ride all 3 sometimes, but typically there might be a state championship for a 125 or a 250 championship somewhere
in
another
state. They would divide it up.
So we'd be jumping around. And then the Mr. Motocross series was the biggest thing.
Yeah, what is Mr. Motocross? So that Motocross Action loved to tell everybody that you were Mr. Motocross, right?
Yeah, well, Mr. Motocross is just a name that the promoter, Vince Tesserero, who was a legend in Australia and a man before his time.
Okay.
How he promoted it, what he did,
was
just well before his time. Still a great friend of Vince now. And he would start this Mr. Motocross series. And initially it was only...
So separate from the National Series.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a series that was 3 rounds initially.
Okay.
And it was at a track called Amaru Park in Sydney, which was really fast, mm-hmm. not too much of a motocross track. Big long straight in it, big jump on it. And he would do 4 lap races back to back.
Oh,
that's what it is.
Okay.
But that developed from the early days into 4 20 minute motos back to back with 5 minutes break between each one.
No way. That's what Mr. Motocross was.
That's at the end of it. That's what I used to compete in. And all those guys that think of 30 minute motos hard now, get over it, boys, because
different size bikes or same
no, bike? No, big bikes, 490, 500s.
It was
all big bikes.
Yeah, yeah.
But he had kid motocross, he had junior motocross, he had Mr. Motocross, he had all these series.
Every round was that way? 3 rounds of that or just 1 week? Or 1 race?
It developed into 5 rounds of those 4 races per day.
Oh my God. So 5 rounds of that.
Yeah. it was tough. But he did that because he heard from me and others.
And just combine your scores? Combine your motor scores?
Yeah.
Like, lowest.
On a points basis, And he did that because he wanted to see Australia level get better.
Yeah.
And compete against, that's when Europe was 45-minute motos plus a lap.
Right.
So that's why he wanted to go for a longer duration.
He wanted to go more.
But it was
5-minute rest.
5-minute rest. From when the last guy came into the back of the pit area, 5 minutes, and the gate dropped again for the next one.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that was...
You're just guzzling water.
Yeah, well, you're trying to put in some good stuff and then change a jersey or clean a goggles. And
you won that 4 times?
You won that? Yes, yeah. I won that four times. 78, 80, 81, 82.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I missed out on the win in the last round in 79 and 83.
Oh, so you could have been six.
Could have been six, but could have been is not a good word.
Yeah.
I was four, but that's good enough.
What do you mean you like lost in the last moto?
Yeah. Okay. No, last race of the four.
Oh, the last round. Yeah.
The first time was my good friend now, Anthony Gunter. He had got a factory 370 RN Suzuki shipped over from
Japan. Oh, really? From like Japan Jean Robert era.
For the last round, and it was a rocket ship, and he was on this day. And I couldn't compete with him, and I had a 21-point lead going into the last round.
Okay,
And he eclipsed that and beat me on the day.
Okay,
And then the last time was a guy called Ray Vandenberg, who unfortunately hurt his knee and ruined his career, and he was a great young rider. And poor Ray, went out of the sport through the injury. He was Team Honda after he won on Suzuki this year in 83. I was leading going the last round again. And unfortunately, my mate, the promoter, makes it double points in the last round.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much, Vince.
Yeah.
And so I had some pressure on me, and Ray was riding really good. This was his home track. And there was an uphill double that I made a mistake on and concussed myself.
Okay.
And these days, they never would have let me go back out again. But, of course, I went out. It didn't go as well. Lost that round too. So
was it almost more like, again, because I just read about this in Motocross Action, so I just assumed this was the most prestigious championship in Australia.
It was.
So it was more so than the national series. Like you could be national champion, but if you won Mr. Motocross, that was more important.
Because the national series was one day, two races.
Oh. Oh, there was no series. Okay, got it.
This was the series.
Yeah, this was it.
Yeah, this was it. This showed who the best guy was in Australia.
So when you're racing in Australia, you're doing, what do you, if there's no Mr. Motocross, that's 5 weekends, right? At the end, it was 5 rounds. Mm-hmm. And there's 2 rounds for the national series. What are you doing in between? Just club races? Just whatever?
Big races, interstate.
Okay.
Like a 250 championship, a 500 championship. Okay. Then there's dirt track, which is flat track.
Yeah.
I do flat track as well. I did that a lot.
At some point, Yamaha supporting you.
All through this.
They care about Mr. Motocross.
Yeah.
Yamaha does? That's what you're gearing towards?
Yeah, but I was winning in dirt track, and they were selling bikes there too, so it didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
And then I did desert racing, the Think Desert race, which is quite an extraordinary desert race, different to our desert races, different to the race here in America.
Now, you told me too, at some point, you got a factory bike from Yamaha. You had a factory bike.
I managed to ride two of them in 77.
Which we had Yamaha riders in Canada. You know, the best guys in Canada were Yamaha supported, but there's no factory bikes getting to Canada.
We got a bit lucky there. Yeah. In 77, I rode a factory 250. And then in 81, they sent over one of the really trick OW51 PowerVal 500cc factory bike. And there was only five in the world.
Like what, Glover race? Same basic thing?
Yeah, but we missed out on the linkage suspension that evolved from the low triangulation of the swing arm, which didn't work too good. So I had a production bike and a factory bike during that year. And if the track got really rough, I'd ride the production bike. If the track was smoother and needed the power of the PowerVal 4-speed 500cc, which was just a rocket ship, so linear off the bottom, really nice engine, I'd ride that.
Yeah.
So I had this choice of the two.
Oh, that's pretty cool to get a factory bike. Yeah, pretty neat.
It was.
So what are you pulling down at your peak, like money-wise? Are you making, like the early 80s, are you making 100 grand a year or 200 grand a year? Like,
yeah, around the 100,000.
Around 100,000. So life's pretty good for you around this time.
Yeah, it was for that time, that money. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, you look at you hear the salaries of, Glover and Hannah and those guys, and, Hannah's making 300.
Yeah.
And he's winning everything in America, so it's not far off, right?
Yeah, it's... with contingencies over here, it got to be much, much better. Yeah.
But then there's this little bugger, Jeff Leese, coming on at some point. Is this like, when do you see this kid?
Yeah, well, I saw Jeff in the young days and on a mini bike, and then I actually stayed with the Leese family in one of the trips to California one year.
That's crazy. I had no idea that he did that. Yeah.
And I think he's just on a 125 then and riding Saddleback and all that where we went and showing a lot of skill. Actually, just recently, I gave him pictures of him jumping over the road and over a van at Saddleback Park.
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
And I had him in my camera and I gave
him. Leese on an 80 was in California?
Yeah,
riding?
Very, very early, but then a more 125 as a junior. Yeah. And so
the Leese family had money.
Yes.
If they're coming to California at that young of an age.
That helped. That helped. That helped get him over here, and he did well.
And you were like, oh, fuck, this kid's coming. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I knew he was coming. And unfortunately, he was in my team, in the Toshiba Yamaha team, okay, for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And actually, he tells a funny story, Jeff, too, and I only heard this recently, that my manager of the team made him wash my bike sometimes in the early days.
Really?
Yeah. Because I was the king, and he was coming up.
Right.
And he had to wash my bike. Poor Jeff. I felt sorry for him when I heard that. But, Jeff came. And then he went to Team Honda in 84, and a guy called Gary Benn, who went to Europe in 79 to wrench for Mike Lem and another Yamaha guy who was a very good rider in Australia. And then he developed going into the Yamaha team in Holland, the motocross team.
Yeah.
Then became the team manager.
So this is like Carla Quist, Neil Hudson, these days.
Yes, all that, that era.
Right.
And but anyway, in 84... he came back to Australia and wanted a life in Australia to bring his kids back for school.
Yep.
He went back to Europe after this, but this particular time he came back to Australia and he became Jeff's mechanic.
Okay. So and super smart guy.
Super smart. Knew a lot about suspension. Still does. Still works with Craig Dack and the Yamaha team.
Yep.
Together, they've won over 25 national championships.
Yeah.
So they're a fantastic team, and Craig does an awesome job with it over there at the moment.
Is Dak a little after Leask or around Leask time?
Around Leask.
Okay,
yeah.
So you got two of these kids.
Yeah.
Coming up.
And Glenn Bell, another kid that came on.
True.
And they definitely wiped me off the planet, which was fine. But in hindsight, I didn't do it right. I blame myself. I don't blame them because I had the skill, but I didn't have the package right.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say, if Leask is on a Honda in 84 and you're still on a Yamaha in 84, the Hondas were a better bike right around then. They were a better bike.
They were nice.
Maybe Leask's titles are, maybe they're not legit.
No. They're always legit. Jeff's a great guy.
But so when does he first beat you?
I can't even remember
when
he first beat me. But in 84, he won nearly every race that year in Mr. Motocross.
Okay. So 84 was really a turning of the...
He just wiped us that year. Really did.
So how was your relationship being the Aussie motocross king? Now you're seeing the future. How was that?
It's fine. I never
really?
Got dirty.
No rivalry, nothing? No?
No, I'm not negative on that sort of stuff. If you're good enough to beat me, you're good enough to beat me. That's the way life is, you know?
Yeah. I did a podcast with Jeff 10 years ago, if not longer. I just rung him up out of the blue. I got his number from somebody. Yep. He was the nicest guy.
Yep.
He was so cool to talk to. He was head of KTM at that point.
Yep.
He's no longer, right? He's not running KTM anymore. And I wish I would have asked him more about, I don't remember if we talked about beating you or not. I was more interested in his American stuff. But 84, he starts beating you. Dax there now, right? So you're kind of seeing the end for you, like, as a winner?
I can certainly see the end coming up. And for Craig, for instance, Craig and I, as a young kid, I mentored Craig, and we trained together. We rode together a little bit. And back in that day, I'd kick his ass. And I remember him sort of finishing runs sometimes, and I'd be sprinted off in the distance and finishing. He was struggling to keep up with me. And I remember one day saying, Craig, one day you're going to kick my ass, mate. Don't worry. Just hang in there. Sure enough. It came around, and Craig took over from Team Honda when Jeff went to America.
Okay.
And then Craig, where I won four Mr. Motocross, so did Craig.
Yeah.
Jeff would have won four or more if he stayed in Australia as well. But Craig won four, and then it's only been Jay Marmont, who was under Craig's tutelage after that. He's another guy that's won four. So and now last year, Dean Ferris has won four national championships.
Yeah.
So there's now four of us that have won four each.
But the Mr. Motocross series is gone. When was it? It ended in
89.
89 was the last one with the four motos, 40 minutes.
At the end of it, it was tough at the end of it.
They should bring it back. Let's bring Mr. Motocross back.
Yeah, well.
Hey, if we did it in America, these guys would die. These kids would die.
People I tried to do that back there, but Vince himself has got the name registered.
Oh, he does. Okay.
And he doesn't really want to do it anymore. That's in the area.
Let's get this going, Vince. Let's get this name back.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I reckon.
Yeah. You know, I always admired Leask because, like you said, you were making a good money in Australia. And, you know, and this is this, going back to being Canadian and looking at some Dylan Wright, for example, great Canadian rider. Making good money. You know, he did the MXGPs one year during COVID, but he could expect. I get a little frustrated at some of the great Canadian riders because they don't put themselves out there. They were happy with the money like you were. I always admire Leask because, like, he could have stayed there. Instead, he went to America, and he had a horrible crash at one of the races, broke his jaw and everything. There's a photo of him upside down. And then he got a factory Yamaha ride, then a factory Honda ride, and he was a top three guy in 500 Nationals, factory Honda, and said, nope, I'm going to Europe. I always admired that. Like, he seemed to be like, I want to challenge myself at every step.
Yeah.
I always thought that was pretty cool because he could have rested on his laurels in Australia.
Yeah.
You know?
And he would have won a world championship in 89, yeah, the last year there, because he ran out of fuel
yeah,
in Finland,
yep,
in the sand track there. And if he won that race, he would have beat Eric Bors, I think it was, that year,
yeah,
and won the world title, which, yeah, is such a shame for,
yeah,
Jeff.
Yeah.
He put in such a good effort.
Yeah. So I always admired him for that, right? Mm. Like, that's a scary thing to leave, like the Lawrences or whatever, too. You know, like Dazzy was on our show and said, you know, they basically took $70,000 to Europe and had to live off that. And Ken Roczen's dad bought them a camper at some point. You're just like, you know, shit's hard, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Take
your hat off to them, yeah, for that effort. Doesn't always win for everyone, but
yep,
but it certainly won for them. That's good.
So when was your – so, okay, Dak and Leask are coming, and well, then Leask leaves. But when's your last race? And did you know it was your last pro, like last career race? Like, were you over it?
I was over motocross because I was over putting the effort in,
okay,
and my knee, because I tore the ACL, yeah, in 86.
Yep.
It never let me get on top of things, and
okay,
I kept clicking it out all the time, even though wearing the best bracing that I could put on there.
Yeah.
It just was loose. And so I was got disheartened because of that.
Yeah.
I rode a lot of like arena cross, stadium motocross, small stadium motocross stuff called the Supercross Masters.
Okay.
We had a great promoter called Phil Christensen in Australia that ran those for a lot of years. And they were fun to do,
yeah,
little bogus little indoor tracks,
yeah,
and they, yeah, were fun.
Danny Laporte showed up at one.
Yeah, Danny came over. Yeah,
Rex Staten came over.
Yeah, well, they were in bigger facilities,
okay,
actually.
Yep.
Mike Bell was there.
Yeah, yeah.
I got a picture standing beside Mike Bell in 79,
okay,
at one of the first ever Supercrosses,
okay,
in Australia.
Oh, so you're still in your prime at this point when they're doing these.
Yeah. And Chuck Sun came over.
Yeah.
I had a fantastic trip back from America. I was in America racing, and they brought me back to Australia for a Supercross.
Okay.
Chuck Sun and Goat Brecker on the plane.
Okay.
The stuff that Goat said to Chuck through that just made me laugh. He's just the man of psyching people out.
Chuck's around here.
Yeah.
We might have saw him mountain biking
actually,
maybe. Yeah.
Actually, Chuck sent me a text saying we should catch up.
Yeah, he's around here.
But I don't know how to contact him. But
I think I'll give you his number if you
all
want.
All right, yeah, I'll give him a ring.
So when was your last race? What year?
89.
89.
Yeah, it was a Supercross Masters,
yeah,
an indoor stadium.
Yeah. Did you know that was it? Were you like, I'm done?
I forget.
Yeah.
I forget exactly. But I knew I was going to training.
The coaching and training.
Because I liked the coaching and training.
Yep.
And Yamaha was keen to see that happen.
Yeah.
And there was a future for me to go forward. So that's why I morphed into doing that.
Yeah.
And that really helped because there's no one doing it in Australia then.
Yep.
And I was one of the only ones. Everyone wanted me to come to their area, to their club, and to teach a school. And I was getting big numbers. I'd always have someone to do my demonstrations, and I would talk through the demos and make sure there's quality in what
CTI's
I did.
CTI's rolling around this time too, right?
Talking about... I basically taught everyone about knee brace in Australia back in those days, you know, because from my injuries, I wanted to see people ride safely. So knee bracing. I always started my schools with a talk about safety gear.
Yeah.
Where these days they don't, you know, and I always had talk about the control setup of the bike, but these days they don't too much. So I try to organize a school to teach an overall concept of motocross. I talked about nutrition. I talked about hydration. I talked about the psychological aspect. I talked about starts and the psychology of starts and all those things, which are important to be an overall racer.
Yeah.
But when you're at one of those schools, you could get a guy that's an A grader and a guy that's the first time rider.
You don't even know, right? Yeah.
No. So you've got to talk at different levels.
I did some schools in the mid 90s as a local pro, and I'd be like, whose hair has checked their sag? And you'd get like two hands. You're like, okay, hold on. Bring your bike over.
Yeah.
Let's check your sag.
Yeah.
Like just basic
stuff.
You know, and you don't you assume people do that, but you shouldn't really assume that.
Well, all of those schools morphed into advanced schools as well, which I had specialists on suspension come in, specialists on motor people come in, even specialists on physical training sometimes come in, talk to the group.
Yeah.
And we ran a lot of advanced training schools. And I know that Kyle Webster came from West Australia over to the other side of the country to deal with that a couple of times.
Yeah.
I really feel as though we've injected a lot of help into Australia over the years. And the current guys that are out there
probably don't realize what we've done back in the day, but I feel so good about what I've done.
Do you feel like, look, it's disheartening to me as an older guy. I talk to some of these young kids now, and I ask them about Rick Johnson. Or even, you know, we had a kid on our show. I forget who it was. I might not even say his name because I don't want to embarrass him. But he was like, yeah, I kind of remember Carmichael. Do you know what I mean?
Really?
Like, yeah. And you're just like, fuck my life. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And look, you're older than that. Do you feel like in Australia people know the stuff you've done and what you've achieved? And do you feel like, you know, like you're still relevant there and everything? Like,
well, I do amongst the older people who know exactly. And I get so much respect from those people.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
I
get people come up to me all the time about the schools that I did, and not just about the technique on the bike, but about life skills.
Yeah. Yeah.
People say, I went on to run a business and I loved it.
That's cool.
And I feel so good about that.
Yeah.
I really do. But these days, the young kids, they don't have a clue, but that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
problem.
Right. Right.
Whatever, you know, like I'm just humbled to think that I've done a lot for the sport, and I feel really good about it. And every time someone comes to me, they go, oh, I don't want to get in your face or anything, but, and I go, you're not getting in my face.
Yeah.
I said, this is fantastic. It makes me feel so good that I helped you back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It really does get to my heart. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, God, I look at your stuff and I'm just touching the surface here, and I look at all the things you've accomplished and all the people you've talked to and touched and helped. Right? It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Kind of cool. You just hope that people appreciate it. And like you said, you get people talking to you.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. And it makes you feel really good. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's gotta be pretty neat.
Yeah. Special.
Before we wrap this thing up, motorsport.com, go there. A number one online ordering place out there. Motorsport.com. They sponsor the Motocross National Hole Shots as well as the Pulp MX Fantasy FFLs. Great pricing, great selection, OEM and aftermarket parts. They got a dedicated team of gearheads to help you there. Motorsport.com. Thank you to those guys for coming on. This is going to be a couple of hard questions for you probably, but greatest race you had. Like just a race where maybe in one of those international supercrosses, maybe, you know, or one of those Mr. Motocrosses.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, I got a couple.
Yeah.
Probably when I beat Jimmy Winant in Sydney Showground in Sydney once.
Yeah. What year was that?
81.
81.
There was 20,000 people cheering.
Yeah.
And you could hear above, goal, goal, go, goal.
Yeah,
you know, all this
sort
of stuff, which is pretty crazy to think about.
And Winart was still good. Like, it wasn't like he was older. Like, he was still good.
And I managed to beat him that time. And where the year before, Marty Smith and Rex Staton was there.
Okay.
And they both beat me. Rex hit me in the air and the quads, and we fell down, and he got up before me. He knew he would.
Rex was famous for hitting people.
We sort of had a bit of a coming together, and Marty got me. So I finished third to those guys that time, and the next I managed to beat. So that was special.
Yeah.
Another one for me is probably winning the Fink Desert Race, which another American, Jimmy Ellis, was there this year.
Yep.
So Jimmy went down 5 minutes faster than me. And 5 minutes at an average speed of 70 mile an hour, 110 kilometers an hour, is a long way.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long way. And I went, oh, Jimmy, you just got this hose, mate. You're going to beat me.
Yeah.
I'm a realist. I knew he was going to hose me going back. Because he had the ability, when he wanted to hold it on, Jimmy could hold it on.
Yeah.
Like, seriously. He did some crazy stuff over there. Anyway, about 10 kilometers 7 mile out of Fink, where we stayed overnight, he blew the barrel off the 550 KTM, blew the barrel off. So I cruised past, and Jimmy's waved me on as I went past. I went, thank you, Jimmy. I'm $10,000 richer.
I'll take that.
So that was a special one.
Yeah.
And another special thing I've done is in sprint cars.
Okay.
I managed to... 1 year, the Australian Sprint Car Championships. This was the best and the worst, right?
Okay.
Get this one.
Yeah.
I'm maybe...
What year is this? Is this long after your moto career?
This is in 99.
Like, okay, so 10 years.
I've done 10 years of sprint car racing at this stage.
Right.
We got fifth 1 year.
Are you still doing flat track or no? You've given up the flat track.
No, I've given that
okay,
up.
All right,
yeah,
okay.
That finished in 89.
Okay. So you quit moto and flat track same time.
And I managed to win the Australian Speed Car Championships, which is the midgets, non-wing midgets, 2.5 litre.
Yeah.
I managed to win that 1 year, then stepped into sprint cars, 10 years of sprint cars. I've gone to Warrnambool in Victoria, country town, famous speedway track down there.
Yeah.
We're racing a 40-lap Australian Championship, one night, one race.
Yeah.
It's the iconic event in speedway in Australia. And I've come out of, I think, eight or something on the grid and worked my way forward. Dumsney and Tatnall were in front of me. And and then Robbie Farr was behind me. He's a famous rider. Okay. But all these guys are famous. Tatnall's been in America for years.
Okay.
Max Dumsey, his son won the Australian Championship recently, which is really cool.
Yep.
He's been around for a long time. And we're at the last corner, and Robbie Farr does a slide job on me, wipes my front wheel out, turns me into the fence, turns the car over, and I'm within two stone throws of the checkered flag.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Third in the the national championship, which I wanted to get onto the podium before I finished sprint car racing because we really couldn't afford it. And it was the highest and the lowest of my career.
Sure.
You know, I got a picture of the car, the front ends tore off it. I faced Robbie afterwards. Oh, you should have seen me coming. Yeah, what peripheral vision do you have in a helmet?
Right,
You're on the cush. You're about 4 feet off the wall.
Yeah.
Any mistake and you're in the wall and rolled over.
Yeah, yeah.
You're doing 80 mile an hour on the cush and he wipes me out and he thinks nothing of it.
Right.
But he went on to do that with multiple people in his career.
Yeah.
And it just, I'm still dirty on that day.
Sounds like it. Yeah.
It's one of the dirtiest days of, you know, because I didn't achieve what I wanted to.
Yeah.
And it was not long after that that I just got wiped out another race and people weren't appreciating racing or the machines we're using.
Yeah.
Because I always wanted to look after my machine.
Yeah.
And so I gave up sprint car racing. It just became too costly, too difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And your perfect night could be ruined by somebody, some other idiot, right?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Happens. So. And you watch, I watch sprint cars all the time. Yeah. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not divorced from it. There's so many people out there. The top guys here get wiped out all the time by something happening.
Yeah.
Because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You just can't help it.
Yeah. It's like what they say about Talladega or Daytona, the super speedway NASCAR ones. They're like, you could be having a race of your life. And somebody hits a fender over here, and you're done, you know? So
But there's some special races. I've even raced jet skis.
Oh, really?
You know, in my time, I've done so many different things. It's been good fun.
Yeah.
Really has been,
you're here for 6 weeks, right? Hanging out, just like you said, boys trip, right? What's the longest you've spent here? Just a few months, like back in the day? Did you ever want to move here, or did you ever want to?
Yeah. In the early days, I really wanted to move to California.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, it just got busier and busier, and I don't like sitting in traffic all the time.
Yeah.
And then it's really hard to when you go back to Australia, it's so good.
Yeah.
It really is.
I got to get there. I got to get there.
Yeah, you got to come down and go mountain bike with me. There's so many good trails to ride and so many places to be. The beaches are beautiful and it's just not as busy as here.
Yeah.
Although this still is a great place.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
How closely do you follow our supercross and motocross stuff?
I watch every race.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you're in tune.
It's for me, it's a supercross Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's on Sunday afternoon at home.
Right.
And the family comes around. We sit around there and watch Supercross Sunday.
Okay.
Sometimes my grandkids are in my arms and I'm watching the Supercross Sunday.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It is cool.
Yeah. So you're still up on it and everything else.
I love it.
Following it. So.
Love it. Yeah.
Wow. What a life. Cool, man. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. We've touched on most of it, but pretty cool to look back at all the things you've done, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a really good life. And, I just got to be thankful to a lot of people out there that have helped me along, and Yamaha particularly, and my wife.
Yeah. Yeah, she sounds like the real trooper of the family. Well, you're off e-biking in Vegas and Salt Lake City. And
40 years together this year, so it's really good. And she's been a great girl.
Right. You still have like memorabilia from your racing days? You still have trophies and everything and all
that? I got all that stuff.
Yeah, you got all? Yeah.
Yeah.
You weren't one of those guys to like not care about it? Yeah.
No, Dackie threw it all away.
Did he?
Yeah. Because I say to him, give me something I can auction off to raise money for our team. You know, I keep pulling out of my stocks of things.
Right.
And
he's like, I got nothing.
Nah, I've sold it. He said, I've just given it or I've junked it or whatever. And I went, Craig, come on. We're going to make money for the team with this stuff. Because even nowadays, you know, we only get probably a third of what we need to run our Motocross of Nations effort.
Yeah.
So there's a crew of us, Jeff Leese, myself, Mark Lutzidge, Gary Benn to a smaller extent.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Michael Burns, the team manager on the day, and Gary Benn helps on the day. But three of us do most of the stuff in Australia.
Yeah.
And Mark Lutzidge is just like the chairman and the organizer of it all. And we do this in conjunction with Peter Doyle MA.
MA, yeah.
And it's hard work. There's a lot to do.
Oh, yeah.
But
I wish Canada, I wish we had that kind of organization and drive for our team. You know what I mean? Like, we've sent ragtag teams before and borrowed bikes. You know, just like you're not going to give yourself much of a chance of success, right?
Yeah.
So I wish we did that. Stephen Gall, thank you, man. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for going mountain biking with me.
Yeah, no, enjoyed it, Steve.
I'm glad to get you in the studio. Randy Richardson from Michelin is the one who texted me that said his buddy said that you were here. So I want to shout out Randy for getting me your number from his buddy in Australia.
That was Greg Nicholson, who I talked about.
Oh, that's okay.
Went the Randy connections.
Okay. Yes. Okay. All right. So there we go.
There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Randy Richardson got me your number, and I'm super stoked to have connected with you and everything else. So thank you for doing the Racer X podcast. Congratulations on everything, all your success. And I'll come down to Australia and you take me e-biking this time.
No problem.
Thanks, Stephen.
And thank you very much, Steve.
This has been the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, Motorsport.com, and Kuba Links on RacerXOnline.com. Thanks for listening and supporting our partners. Don't change the air. Don't change the air.